Welcome back. It's another edition of the Film Experience podcast. This one's devoted to Mad Max Fury Road. And today's guests are Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
Happy Carol Day.
Anne Marie.
Happy Carol Day to you, Nick.
And we have a new guest, Kyle Stevens, who, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I was telling Kyle earlier, I have a huge Twitter crush on him. So I'm very happy he's joining us, but it turns out he knows Nick in real life.
Yeah, I am a film studies, well, soon to be visiting assistant professor at Colby College in Maine. I'm just finishing up a postdoc in film studies at Brandeis. I tend to look at American cinema, Hollywood cinema. I have a new book coming out. It's called Mike Nichols' Sex, Language, and the Reinvention of Psychological Realism. So I'm excited about that.
Wow, and you know, Mark Harris will be chasing you on that since he's doing a bio.
He is, yeah. Mine's not very much a bio. It's more
Right.
reading the films and
More academic.
yeah, there is some biography in there, but I mean, he'll do an amazing job. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
Mark Harris has been chasing Kyle for a while. Okay.
Yeah.
That won't be new for anybody.
Well, so welcome everyone. It seems like people are you all as orgasmic about this movie as the early reviews?
Mostly.
Show of hands.
My hand's halfway up.
Mine is halfway up as well.
First, I'd like to know your history with the Mad Max franchise. And the only strong memories I have of it at all is the, you know, the first third or what have you of Beyond Thunderdome, where it gets its title. Didn't really have strong connections to the original trilogy. But how about all of you? Have you seen all three?
Well, I still want to know how orgasmic you are.
Oh, quite.
Oh, well.
I'm younger than all of the Mad Max movies, so I did not get a chance to ever see a Mad Max movie in theaters before this film, which is part of the reason that I decided to go to this one. That said, I did watch all three of them in college back to back, starting at like 1 a.m. one night. And so my memories of the movies are all very blurred together in this kind of hallucinogenic few hours of lots and lots of hair gel and spikes. I'm a little hazy on the details of the original. Can you call them a trilogy? Because they don't seem to be all that connected to each other. And it seems like at points the movie is a little hazy on some of the details too.
I've seen the We Don't Need Another Hero music video many times. I have a strong memory of some kind of necklace, headpiece, Tina Turner situation, but I don't think I ever actually saw any of the other movies. So
Okay.
this was all new to me.
I'm in a similar situation as Nick. I do remember the video, but I remember it kind of the way I think if you watch Arrested Development, Buster sees Lucille Bluth. I just sort of remember brown points, spikes, sort of Tina Turner hair. And I did see the original Mad Max film. In college, I think there was an Australian student, like someone lived on my hall, and he made everyone watch it. But it was more about like him telling us how everyone has to drink a certain kind of beer when they watch it. I mean, it seems like there's a kind of ritual that goes with watching it in Australia, so I don't really remember very much of the film.
I wanted to talk about the opening scene, and whether or not you felt it was kind of a misdirect, because it starts with Mad Max. This podcast will be full of spoilers, so we're expecting that we're not going to worry about that. I don't really think it's a movie you can spoil per se, because it's more about the experience of watching it. But if you haven't seen it, you might want to do that before listening to the podcast. But in the opening scene, you know, Mad Max is narrating. It's like, I think most of his dialogue is in that prologue, to the movie.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you feel about the fact that he's sort of threaded through the movie, but he turns out to not quite be the protagonist, because that was something that I thought was really subversive and great, and I was not expecting it at all.
I'm so pleased that you wanted to talk about the introduction. There is something about that moment for me that's been the one that sticks with me in the film and like trying to figure out what it's doing. It seems like we have to go back to that introduction when it kind of you know, and we're getting the, like, little gecko lizard thing with the two-headed gecko kind of wandering up, and it's like, yes, this is a cartoon, yes, it's kind of alien, but it, and, like, does suggest that he might be mad, right? Because he eats it, but yeah, I mean, but it, he also sounds really sane, right? I mean, he's making a lot of sense, or at least he's, I mean, you're right, it's the only time we get, like, his interiority, right, or any kind of motivation. Mm-hmm. He's talking about survival. Like, right, so he says something about being reduced to a single instinct or something. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question for me is, like, does that change? Is he, like, not alone by the end? Does he want to do something other than just survive? And I feel like that's kind of important to the movie.
Hmm. I like that he got apprehended so fast.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that, you know, he's actually pretty, like, you know, good at being apprehended. He's not very good. I mean, the question has to be rhetorical at a certain moment. Like, if you're asking me, was I excited that the man turned out to be secondary and the protagonists were a bunch of women by surprise? Of course, I liked that. And yeah, I liked that there was that whole huge production number that seems like it is him sort of getting away, even though that's not what actually happens by the end. It seemed like it was just going to be a big old Casino Royale piece of daring do.
Yeah.
Which it was, but with all the little descent monsters running around. I mean, it did mean that, like, within the first 5 minutes, I already was confused about a couple things, and that was just going to stay true for the rest of the film, but that's, you know, I can live with that.
Yeah, I had the same trouble with Nick in that, well, not trouble, but I got thrown into the middle of the movie, and I love, or in the middle of the plot, and I love movies that start, you know, in media race. I think it's a great conceit. But on the other hand, I had no bloody idea what's going on. I'm still not entirely sure why he's basically used as a human blood bag. But it was a fun way of connecting him with, oh gosh, what was that character's name? It was something fantastic. Nux?
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you asked me to describe beat by beat what the plot of this movie is, I don't think I could do it, but I don't know that any of us went in to be able to give a clear and concise breakdown of Mad Max Fury Road's plot points. So it didn't upset me as much as it probably would have.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually prefer plots where I have to catch up. So I also agree that that's a great and surprisingly underused way to do movies lately. Because it seems like movies, maybe I'm just thinking of like huge mainstream blockbuster like Star Wars, maybe there's a ton of examples to the contrary, but it seems to me like we used to have this notion that you start when it's already exciting.
Yeah.
and then now we have this, like, now everything's origin stories and like these really complex things before anything starts happening. And I much prefer just throw me in, I'll catch up, you know, because I want the experience of like a full movie, not like a preamble to a movie. So I loved that about it, and I love that the sort of prologue was kind of cut short, you know, like as you were saying, Kyle, like he's to, you know, he's reduced to one instinct, and then it just sort of starts, you know? He doesn't really, like, complete his interior monologue, and it's just all of a sudden, you have to, oh, why is he suddenly stopping and running, you know? And then I liked that that was a misdirect, because as you guys said, he's captured right away. But I also don't think the plot is that important, other than something to hang, you know, the other things on, which is, you know, to me is very true of action movies in general and musicals and other like heightened genres, where I think if you get too plotty, it distracts from you know, the money shots, which in various genres are various different types of things. In action, it's the set pieces, and musicals, it's the numbers, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Age of Ultron says what?
Trying not to say that.
We all were thinking it.
We were. Though I do think this movie does a good job of like doing things visually. I mean, it doesn't explain the blood bag use of Mad Max, but it does seem to make sense given that they're so pale, right? I mean, it's kind of like you just assume they're seriously anemic and they need, you know, he's a universal donor, so it's fine.
That's true. He is one of the only people who has the kind of tan you would expect from people living in the middle of a post-apocalyptic desert.
Yeah, he and Charlize certainly are singled out as stars.
Yeah.
They're just as orange and teal as the rest of the movie.
But sometimes just orange. And wasn't that a nice break?
Yes.
Wait, before we go on from the introduction, did anyone else think it was kind of funny that... So he's peeing, right?
Yeah.
When I was thinking about the beginning, I mean, the whole movie is about, like, making water, which I mean, it may be, like, an old-fashioned Southern phrase for peeing. Like, maybe it's a kind of Wizard of Oz moment, like we had the power in us all along.
It would have been too obvious if they'd put him in a blue and white gingham dress, so I'm glad it was a subtler illusion.
He could, yeah, it's just, where was the homage to Waterworld? Like, shouldn't he have drank the pee afterwards?
Wait, but does Waterworld need an homage?
It doesn't need one, but...
Oh, okay.
They missed the opportunity, is my point. So in terms of, like, the critical response, like, we're all positive about it, and I guess some have some hesitations, but what has been your favorite thing that somebody else has said about it so far?
Well, I wasn't originally planning to see this movie this week, but then I read that absolutely insane article or rant by Aaron Clary, that men's rights activist.
Oh, right.
Oh, gosh.
Gotta stop following him.
Oh, it was going on and on about... He hadn't even seen the movie. It was just watching the trailer. He realized that this was part of the feminist propaganda. And I was like, well, I mean, I have to add it to my feminazi review for this week. Like, I would be a bad feminist if I didn't go see this movie and, like, give my money and support to a movie that clearly ticked this guy off so much.
Right.
So I am glad to say that he is absolutely right. I am so glad that he pointed this out to me so that I could go have this experience of watching Charlize Theron, a bunch of grannies on motorcycles, and a bunch of supermodels, like, destroy the post-apocalyptic patriarchy.
It's just sad that you missed the meeting where they screened this in advance for you guys.
I know, I missed it. And there was, like, a head shaving workshop and, like, all of this stuff that I totally missed out on.
How to smear grease across your brow? Yeah, all of it.
Yeah.
Sigourney Weaver with the keynote.
Oh, gosh. I would have loved that.
I haven't read a ton of reviews of this movie, but wait, I had the poll quote. You can cut this in post. Somebody else talk, just a second.
Oh, I have one. It's from Todd Vanderwerf, and I read this before seeing the movie, but it was just like a tweet. He said, the first 20 minutes of Fury Road are George Miller saying, I haven't made a live-action movie since 1998. Here are some ideas I've had. Which is totally, like, it is such, like, a grab bag of everything, but that's what I found so energizing about it, is it just, like, it does not let up, and I don't mean that in the typical, like, there's lots of action. I just mean that, like, he's constantly throwing, you think you're seeing one thing, and then it's suddenly, like, something else, you know?
Yeah.
But not in a way that is incoherent.
Right. Well,
I think occasionally have coherence questions.
Oh, yeah.
I did, too.
Okay.
But, I mean, the last movie he made was, what, Happy Feet 2? Like, he has stuff to get out.
I found mine. It's by Robbie Collin in The Telegraph, who's reliable for great zingers at all times, even when he's not, like, not zinger in the sense of disparaging. But he says, imagine if Cirque du Soleil reenacted a Hieronymus Bosch painting and someone set the theater on fire.
Wow.
That's pretty great.
Absolutely. I haven't read that many reviews either. I mean, once the kind of headlines came out and were so, you know, messianic, yeah. I figured I would go see the film. And I'm not a big action person at all. Well, maybe there's a little bit of genre bias, but I mean, I'm just really jumpy. I tend to be scared at almost anything that moves from off screen to on screen. So I avoid them, but I kind of liked, even though this did feel like an assault because it was so intense, at least it didn't like lull you into false periods of complacency and then like bring you back the way
right.
action movies do. Like, there were no sequences, right? So I could just like get tense and stay there, which was kind of easier in a way. Oh, sorry about pull quotes. So I haven't, but the ones that have made it to me, I guess, are similar to the ones that have made it to all of you, all the feminist headlines. The one that I was looking at was Miller saying, "All I know is I cannot think of another female character in cinema who's like her." And I just want, I mean, no one else leaps to mind, but I also want to disagree with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm putting it to you to come up with examples.
Well, it depends on what he meant by that, you know.
I think it's something about her being so angry was the context of the clue. And I feel like, well, that might be different. But then it is just about action movies, because obviously women are angry in a lot of other movies. I mean, Selma. But like,
well, yeah. I mean, and even within the action genre, it's not, you know, people often mistake that genre as being completely masculine, but there's been a lot of fine action movies that had very furious women in it. You know, like Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about someone who has a lot of, you know, rage issues.
Well, you know, when they keep sending robots back to kill your son, it does things to you.
Speaking from personal experience.
Not quite.
I think it's, to me, the fact that so much of the discussion has just been about her casting in a part that is so, you know, either equally matched with Mad Max's or actually kind of supersedes it, does get at something about, though, how I feel like the part is executed. Like, I don't feel like Charlize Theron does a lot with the part. And I felt like I was reacting mostly to the rhetoric of the film often more than execution. Like, it was clear that it was trying to steer me in a direction it was going to call quote-unquote feminist. Mm-hmm. But they felt like placeholders for a kind of gender critique or a commitment to women in this story or in this genre, but I did want a little more once we had kind of started from that exciting foundation. And I don't feel like I had more chances to learn about her than I did to learn about Max, and I didn't learn a ton. Like, that's fine, it wasn't what the movie was about, but
right. Well, and that's actually my one, well, and I'm not even sure it's a critique, so to speak, but when critics get very, very enthusiastic about a movie, tends to be, it's like the sort of A or F phenomenon, where if you love something, everything in it is masterful, which is a problem with modern film criticism. But I didn't actually think it was all that strong of an acting showcase overall. So I did want to talk about the acting, because like, I love the movie, but I wouldn't call it anyone's best work or particularly revelatory. I love Charlize in general, but I agree with what you're saying. And I also think, like, the supporting cast, there's a lot of sort of competent performances, but not a lot of, like, exciting acting. And I do think you can do exciting acting within action movies easily, you know? So I'm curious about, like, any acting beats that you loved. I mean, my favorite one beat is, like, I absolutely love Tom Hardy when he finally it tells them his name.
Yeah.
Because I just thought it was such a funny, Tom Hardy has such great, like, idiosyncrasies to me as an actor. Like, he looks very masculine, but his performances don't ever feel, like, macho to me.
Right.
Which is something I love. Like, they have all these weird, like, he seems like more of a weirdo, and more of like a full person, and more of a full person than action hero.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I like that he seemed almost embarrassed after he said his name. Like, did I just say my name? Anyway, so I was wondering if, like, because I know all of us are acting enthusiasts, you know.
Absolutely.
So did anything thrill you in that department, or were you just kind of like, eh?
No, not particularly. I mean, I agree that it wasn't, it's not like I'm going to sit at the end of 2015 writing my best acting list and say, oh yes, and Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron did performances of their career. I certainly enjoyed Charlize Theron's angry Ellen Ripley in the last half of Aliens performance. I really enjoyed it, but I don't think anybody goes beyond the bare minimum that's required of them in it. Even Tom Hardy, a lot of there was another reviewer, I think for Vulture, who was talking about how Tom Hardy usually has this beautiful face and this expressive beautiful face that doesn't get a lot of use here. And I was like, well, the fact that you're pointing out, which I agree with, the fact that you're pointing out that you're not seeing a lot from him tells me that maybe we are missing a little bit from him in terms of any kind of expressiveness that he might have, but the movie doesn't call for a lot from Max. He's got that cage on his face for such a long period of time.
Tom Hardy's tourist signature is a cage on his face.
Which is ridiculous because he's got like the best mouth in the movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful man keeps covering it up.
That was the injustice we were meant to be so upset about.
Yeah, it was post-apocalyptic, you guys. I don't know if you thought that.
Yeah, that's why Charlize was so angry all the time.
That's right.
But I didn't feel the lack of it in the movie. I didn't walk out of it like wishing I had acting beats from these people. I walked out of it like humming the Ride of the Valkyries, so...
Nicholas Hoult in particular stands out for me. I mean, I think to go from that kind of mania of like, what a lovely day, spray me with chrome, you know, to like being the sort of kind of dewy ingenue by the end. And I think he actually does pull off that transition. I mean, the minor characters seem to have more interesting arcs than Charlize and Tom Hardy's characters. But I kind of like the acting, what they were able to do quickly.
I didn't not like it. I felt like, I mean, I'm guilty of recasting everybody as Vera Farmiga in basically every movie that I watch. Like, that's just a reflex. But I was thinking about all the many things she would have done with her irises that Charlie, like, just tell me more while you're driving. You know, it just seemed like a, you know, the movie's agenda is not to give them like, you know, huge layers. I understand that, but I just thought I would maybe feel all kinds of feelings about Furiosa at the end of the movie that I didn't at the beginning, but. She's had a hard couple of days. She didn't have a lot of time to show me more. Speaking of the whole character, though, in the arc, like, Kyle, do you mean specifically, like, I did find the interaction between him and the Riley Keough character kind of egregious. Like, it seemed weirdly sentimental in the middle of a movie that I just didn't understand as accommodating that. That's not about them as actors, just about the...
About the plot?
Desire to have communion between the two of them seemed very odd to me.
Right, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just giving him motivation to kind of give up his religion.
And I felt like motivation abounded. You worship a guy who has an external lung who will kill you in 2 seconds if he feels like you can have a change.
Right, rational motivation abounded.
Now, obviously, the Mad Max franchise is not something that the Academy will look at unless, you know, people really force it on them. But if you were to hand the movie any Oscars for any reason, what would it be? Or nominations, let's say.
Sound mixing for me.
Good one. I agree with that.
I don't want to interrupt thoughts about sound. Were you going to say more about that?
No, not at all. I just thought.
Sound fixing. Boom. Yeah. I was thinking costume design, both because I loved it and because this is the woman who did the costumes for Room of the View. Like, what? Way to go, Jenny Bevan.
Yeah, and she's like, I've interviewed her before, and it's, you know, it's just, I just, I loved that it was her because I can't imagine her doing it.
Yeah.
And yet she pulled it off.
Yeah, I'll say.
But John Seale's cinematography was fantastic for this film.
Yes.
It was, I remember thinking about this, about Godzilla last year. It was a really pretty movie.
Yeah.
It made, you know, the desert look not only stylish, but just like hallucinatory and gorgeous. All of that, what we were talking about, orange and teal, which are two colors, by the way, that I usually hate in films, because we went through that period in the aughts where, like, everybody had to make a movie that had teal in it. But it was just, it was a beautiful-looking movie, and it was a very coherent movie in terms of how the action was shot. Mm-hmm. Not just edited together, but shot. And I really appreciated that. Despite how, you know, manic the action got, I always knew more or less where everybody was and what everyone was doing. It was playful at points too. Like the first shot of the five wives got a giggle out of me.
Right.
Just the way they were introduced.
Yeah, it was like almost suddenly like a beer commercial. Yeah. Or
yeah.
Or like a Victoria's Secret.
Yeah, Victoria's Secret post-apocalyptic line.
Because they're what's so great is they're so clean in the middle of this, even though they've been riding underneath like a truck or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, they've not just been hoarding water. They've got oil of Olay back there. They've got all kinds of shit in that salt mountain that we don't know about. But
So.
I have to give it a special Oscar for the props department. Because every single time somebody held up a wheel or anything like that and all the insignia of their, you know, their clan or whatever you want to call the Immortan Joe's, like, place, it was just so funny to me. And it so consistent. Like, talk about world building.
Yeah.
The Detroit in you is coming out right now.
Well, there was also Charlize Theron's MacGyver-esque prosthetic arm, which was really well done too. Yeah.
Yeah, and the like sort of the chastity belt moment.
Oh God.
With the sort of huge like what do you call those? The bolts. Oh God, I'm just not a. I'm not. I've never fixed anything or created. You know, I'm not a mechanic.
You're not a chastity
bolt
belt.
Bolt cutters.
Oh, uh-huh.
They had everything involving the bolt cutters just made me laugh.
What about this thing? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to grouch a bit.
Okay.
So, I guess my overall feeling about the movie is that, and the Oscar question kind of gets to it, is that every single aspect of its craftsmanship I really admired, and it was clear that it had kind of nailed its task.
Uh-huh.
But my misgiving about the movie was largely about its sheer relentlessness. Like, in a vocabulary of, did I admire how it looked, how it was put together, how it sounded, like, kind of across the board, yes, it's just so stunning. But I did feel a little, like, partially at the expense of some of its allegory or its ideas, I thought that the just enforcing of physical experience and kind of the aggression coming at me from the screen sometimes confused its thoughts a bit, and it was clear it wanted to have thoughts. Mm-hmm. But also, I just felt not good sitting there. Like, it just it did seem a little oppressive. Maybe above and beyond the Call of Duty.
I was like, but shouldn't dystopias? Because that's kind of my thing with a lot of, like, dystopian films that, like, I mean, The Hunger Games is the easy target, but it just doesn't feel dangerous.
That's true. Totally, like, yeah, I guess I'd have to figure out how to separate, like, the aspect of danger, which I definitely felt, but sometimes, like, you know, if you have that guy in that outfit in tight close-up, and there's a roaring, like, growl behind him, and a crazy guitar going off, like, I'm going to be scared of him. Right? Like, he's doing the That and that beyond just engendering fear, but engendering admiration or excitement or sympathy, like, the movie's devices all seemed kind of crude and almost incredibly so.
Mm. Interesting.
That was my misgiving.
The first thing that I said when I walked out of the movie was that it was like Sia's Chandelier song, which I know you like as much as I do, Nick. Like, it's all chorus, but kind of great. Like, this was actually...
You know, Sia would have fit perfectly into this movie.
She would have.
She would have been a great Imperator.
You just pulled so far into the lead. Keep talking.
Yeah.
Now I'm recasting her. Heaven help me, Tina Turner. But now I'm suddenly seeing her as Auntie Entity. Mm-hmm. Auntie Entity's maybe her niece grown up.
But the relentless thing, I do know what you mean. I read that Charlize said that when she saw it, she felt like she was punched in the face.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess she feels similarly. I'm surprised that I didn't share that. I guess because I did feel that there was enough allegory to pay attention to and enough detail. Mm-hmm. The bureaucrats' nipple rings or the steering wheels. I felt like it wasn't painful for me, I guess, the way it was for you.
Mm-hmm.
I just think if you're going grotesque, go, grotesque. I just loved its commitment to its more Baroque qualities.
Yeah.
Just because so many movies feel so... I mean, I'm not sure what that's going to mean for its public reception, but... Because it does not feel safe ever.
Yeah.
No. And again, I'm used to cowering.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also easily spooked, so I was like... incredibly, like, I basically called up a spa to order a massage afterwards, because I was incredibly tense from like especially that, I mean, the prologue opening with Mad Max failing miserably not to be captured over and over again, mm-hmm. was already like my entire body was like clenched up and that would never release the rest of the movie.
What really clenched me, those wavering sort of poles that the guys were
yes.
like, those things killed me. I was so anxious about those.
Mm-hmm. Especially because holding onto a chainsaw while you flop around a giant pole, like that's a skill you build over years, I imagine.
That's true, though. I'm trying to think of the last action movie that I watched where I felt as like viscerally scared. I think it might have been Gravity, which more has to do with the fact that I never want to be shot into space. So now thanks to these movies, I know that my fear of being shot into space and like dying in the vast vacuum is equal to my fear of being chased down by meatheads wielding chainsaws in the desert.
And these are important things to know about yourself.
They are. Yes, who knew this would be the lesson that I took from Mad Max?
It's a human story.
It's good to be scared of things that are 100% avoidable. It's like sharks. Good. Like that's
I'm not
gonna
happen. I'm not afraid of sharks. I'm afraid of giant squid, though.
Okay, yeah. Well, you're good impulse.
I don't think I've ever been as scared for, like, an action hero as the entire time that Tom Hardy was the hood ornament, because he was just so vulnerable that whole time. Like when he's like his intense like face behind that cage, and he knows like the chainsaws are blades are flying by him, and he can't move at all. Yeah. It really got to me.
Talking about it.
I mean, he's the main character. His name is on the poster. But I did actually feel concerned for him. I was not entirely sure, especially considering how little he was getting to talk, whether or not he was going to make it through the movie. So, that's true. Bravo for raising the stakes enough for me to believe that you could kill your main character.
That's true. His survival did not seem guaranteed.
Well, it was, we were talking about with Age of Ultron a couple of weeks ago, how, you walk into it and you know that all of these folks have future franchises, so you're not particularly worried about any of the main characters getting killed off.
Right.
And even though they announced more Mad Max movies, considering how fast and loose the film played with continuity anyway, I was convinced that, like, more than a few people were going to drop dead. And it could have been Mad Max, so
mm-hmm.
it absolutely made the violence land, mm-hmm. I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I was worried for Furiosa, too. I thought she could easily bite it by the end of the movie.
She had.
Do
you
think some of these stakes could have something to do with the fact that we get, like, a real villain, just, like, pure evil, right? I mean, there's no kind of nuance, like, Ultron kind of makes us believe that, you know, the Ultron thing, he thinks he's doing well, but he's also, you know, made by the heroes. You sort of like, he's kind of like a complicated hero. I mean, not really, I didn't like Ultron, but I mean, or like, you know, like the Joker and Batman and stuff, like we get, like we keep getting these villains who are kind of given depth, whereas this villain is given no depth at all. And I feel like it's been a long time since I've seen an action film where there was just like actual, just sort of evil chasing them. Yeah. So anybody could die.
Yeah.
Yeah, pure antagonism, right? Mm-hmm. Just like at the graphic level, at every level.
No sympathy at all.
Yeah, yeah. Nope. I mean, the Joker was exactly who I was thinking about during the whole movie, just because like how I felt during the scenes of the Joker's most, like, you know, kind of most hyperbolic awfulness in The Dark Knight, where it just literally felt like this, you know, the theater could catch on fire, or we were in the presence of something totally malign. Like, this movie felt that way the entire time. I was impressed with the conviction of that, even though I started to wonder how much do I want to really experience something like this. Mm-hmm. But I agree, the implacability was key. And I was glad they didn't, like, make him talk. Or yeah. It's like when the orcs started talking halfway through the Lord of the Rings series. You're like, but why? Yeah. Better when they just, you know, stamp around and come and get you. Nothing would have been gained by learning more about that guy.
Yeah. Which is, you know, which brings us back to the beginning of, like, you don't have to know everything.
Right.
So, like, let's kill all these, like, prequels and backstories.
Yes. How many times do we have to learn Spider-Man's origin story?
Right.
That said...
Especially because it's like, he got bit once.
No, but it's an untold story. Remember the tagline last time? The untold story.
It was the same goddamn story. I do have to say, while I do enjoy that we had a mostly unexplained villain, and I think everybody was treated more or less with the same either plot carelessness or I don't know what you'd want to call it. Obviously, I walked into this with having my feminazi agenda of supporting motorcycle riding grannies, and I definitely got that, but I took a little bit of issue with the five wives. Like, they walked out with that, like, looking like they were out of a photo shoot from America's Top Next Top Model, like one of the tamer photo shoots. Right. But these women were not chosen for procreation. Like, they don't have childbearing hips. They were chosen because they're hot and they're tall and they fit the aesthetic now. And I, as much as I enjoyed having a lot of really badass female characters, like, riding in and all of that stuff, they also felt very prop-ish, especially the five wives, as a conceit. So I was a little bit conflicted about that, because on the one hand, yes, I thoroughly enjoyed their existence, but on the other hand, like, they didn't seem to thoroughly enjoy their... I wasn't really sure where the movie was going for, besides, look! Scantily clad women! Aren't we glad they're here? Yeah. So, that's my two cents.
I thought that was kind of slightly critiqued over the course of the film, and that's why it mattered, too, that Charlize, who, you know, was and is, I guess, still a model, was saving them. I mean, I felt like because Charlize is so beautiful, we're aware that there is that kind of connection. But also then, like, you know, along, I mean, they get lines, right? And they're like, no, I can do these things, right? I mean, they are treated that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, they know that they're treated as... I mean, there is that line, like, we're not objects or whatever. I mean, it's very, very explicit. And so, like, they sort of get to, over the course of the film, like, kind of show their mettle. And I thought that their looks made it clear. I mean, that was part of what added to the villainy of the villain, right? There is no kind of way that he could have chosen these girls just for procreation purposes. Right. I don't know.
It's one that I'm still struggling with. It's just a tickle in the back of my mind that I'm still struggling with. And I think part of it is just, like, the movie does not give enough context or attention to it. Like, they throw them in there and then it just kind of keeps moving, and I think that's why I'm still struggling with this, because I don't know really where it's going with it, and I don't think the movie does either. I think George Miller just got this great image of, you know, five women walking out of an oasis, and just kind of ran with it and got a great image of a bunch of grannies on motorcycles, like murdering meatheads, and just went with it.
But you know, that's we don't see enough of that in movies built around like somebody who actually has an image that's potent, and several of them, you know.
True. Yeah. But, which is why I'm conflicted and not like just outright saying no, this is just not great. Although somebody who's complaining about not being a an object getting used pretty consistently as an object did kind of give me a giggle. So
yeah. Well, I mean, I liked the movie's sense of humor in all this like dystopian grotesquerie that it was self-aware as well. Yeah. I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do think the movie's a little conflicted about it, too, because I noticed that during the action scenes, especially with the... Are they the Vuvuzelani? Am I getting that right?
Oh, sure. What
do you mean?
exactly, yeah.
That the editing really cut away super fast at any point where one of those women was about to take it in the teeth, or worse. And sometimes to the extent that I could not tell whether a granny had just been punched in the face or had just been killed or if she was gone or if she wasn't. And it was really skittish in the same way that, like, rhetorically, I think it's pretty insane and gutsy that the film is willing to kind of kill off a pregnant woman and have what happens to her happens to her.
Right.
But it's really, you know, possibly to its credit, but given that the movie's so excessive and brutal in some of its imagery, you can tell it does not want to look at that, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so any time that the women were prone to violence, I felt like the film was having a reservation about depicting that.
Interesting.
And I think that's, you know, I'm not here to say that's good or bad, but it just like had set itself on such an extreme of what it showed us for the first 30 minutes was not really comfortable editing in the same way afterward, even though it's really inviting all of them as full participants in the action. And it was part of why I felt again like the movie wanted the women to make a kind of political point about matriarchy or a different set of values, but was angsty about how to balance everything it had pulled in. And it's like you're saying, Nathaniel, I'm glad for a movie that has tried to do too much that it's hard to balance all of it. But,
right.
but, you know, since so many of the reviews had been kind of like...
The greatest thing ever made.
Flawless level. Yeah. Like I feel like you do see some stress marks here.
Right. And we didn't even get to talk about Cannes, but Mad Max Fury Road is a big topic, so we do suggest that everybody sees it, because it's one of those movies, you know, it's going to be one of the, you know, handful of definitive movies this year, so.
Yeah.
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 And thanks to Kyle.
Thank you for having me.
Nick.
Thank you.
And Anne-Marie.
I'm not an object.
I am.